Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris Effects. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. I'm a working film, TV, and documentary editor. Over the last 10 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with the world's best editors. Welcome to episode 13 of season 10. I've been using Boris Effects products for 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today on Art of the Cut, we're talking about Ghostbusters Frozen Empire with editors Nathan Orloff and Shane Reed. Nathan's been a guest on Art of the Cut a few times, including for the last Ghostbusters, Afterlife, and also for John Wick 4. Shane Reed is coming from the world of TV spot editing, as you'll hear in the interview and music videos. He's really starting off his feature film career with this film and, amazingly, another in just a few months, Deadpool and Wolverine, which, by the way, is not something you want to see carved into a tree trunk. Before I hop into our discussion with Nathan and Shane, a brief thank you to our partner, Boris Effects. I've been using Boris Effects and Sapphire for 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris Effects is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris Effects suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. And now, Nathan Orloff and Shane Reed discuss editing Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. I wanted to start out with Shane first, because Nathan, you edited the last Ghostbusters movie, so I wanted to kind of hear about how Shane got onto this one, and I also saw that he's doing the Logan Deadpool movie, and how the heck do you edit two gigantic blockbusters in the course of 2 months or whatever this is going to be released? Obviously, yeah. You didn't do that, but tell us a little bit about getting onto this movie and also juggling the schedules of the two movies.
Well, it was definitely a rare experience. I met Jason doing an Apple ad with him and Ivan. It was the only thing that they had co-directed together. At the time that I was working with them, I was mostly working with Ivan because Jason was on the road for Afterlife. And so I would just get these phone calls from Ivan. He was hysterical and really fun and so sharp. I just spent more time talking to him. And shortly after that, unfortunately, Ivan passed, and I reached out to Jason, and I sort of said, like, I'm not going to pretend to, after one experience, know your family, but all I can really offer, because I know your father is so important to you, is some sort of a story about him that you might not have known. So I just recapped some of our conversations on the phone about how he would jab at the creatives in the process. And he was just really fun and funny, and he was just making light of the situation that we were all in and not being too heavy about it. And Jason was really heartwarmed by that and asked if I would help him to find someone to make a memorial film for Ivan's memorial service. And I was like, I'll do that, you know? And he was like, no, I wouldn't ask you to do that. But I just said to him, like, I grew up watching Ivan's films. If I could help give anything back to his legacy, it would be an honor. And so we worked on that together. And that was the way that we were able to actually, like, spend time on something that was close to Jason's heart. And we got that wonderful time that you get with the director in the room where you're just creating something out of nothing. And then we bonded. And then when this came around, I talked to him about it, and Nathan was on board. He was like, you know, we're just looking for someone else for production. We just want someone else to come in and help build the film while we're shooting it. And I don't know if that's something you're into. And I said, actually, what I have going on the side is a way, 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 way out there Hail Mary possibility of this other film, which I couldn't mention at the time. And I had been having conversations about Deadpool and Wolverine. And so it worked out where, like, Deadpool was starting to shoot on the tail of when Ghostbusters was wrapping. So I was just on helping through production. And that was the understanding. And we were all good with that. And everyone was cool with that. And then we all fell in love with each other working. And it was like, I didn't want to go. And Nathan and I had such a great time working together. But that was kind of the deal we all made. And it was very cool and in the open. I went on to Deadpool. I started working. Strike happens. When the strike happens, immediately Jason Blumenfeld and Jason and Gil start writing to me going, like, can you come back onto this? And So I came on and Nathan and I got a really wonderful like 2 months to dive back into the film and really build it back up before I then had to leave again for Deadpool. So there was a real juggling act, but what was fortunate about it was like I got to kind of come back in and be an objective point of view to what Nathan and Gil had been working on. But I also knew the material, so it helped in a way to like freshen things up and then have Nathan and I get back on the page of what we were originally starting to do.
Crazy time juggling. And Nathan, you have cut yourself. You did John Wick 4 as a solo editor, obviously with a team, but you were the solo editor on that. And then you've also worked on the previous Ghostbusters with a team of editors, and Dana Glauberman was on that. Tell me a little bit about what you like and don't like about having a collaborator when doing it yourself.
I can't say enough positive things about both my record experience with Shane and with Dana. I look at those films as not wanting to trade out, whether it be in a solo film or a duo film, in any way, shape, or form. That the film doesn't make sense to me as imagining doing it solo or not. And I think it just comes down to the, both the material and mainly also the director. And also John Wick, we had a lot of time in post, just the schedule of it all. And not only that, the way he shoots, the way Chad shot that film is incredibly, like he shoots action scenes linear. It actually almost doesn't make sense as much. Doing a film like John Wick specifically, especially with a main character, it's like, that's almost in every single scene. I can't imagine honestly jumping around with two editors. With two editors on a movie like this, you're kind of playing whack-a-mole. Like, all right, you got that scene. This is taking me a while, blah, blah, blah. It's like, you know, if they're shooting this much coverage, you're getting so much more material on this kind of movie and the speeds you need two people. On John Wick, you know, Chad famously doesn't really use any second unit. You know, you're still getting a lot of material, but it's not like you're getting left and right different scenes from different parts of the movie and you're like, my brain would have exploded if I didn't have Shane on this movie.
I think all the John Wick films are solo editors. Elizabeth and Evan and you and...
Correct.
Editing-wise, one of the things that I thought of with all these great actors was performance and trying to pull out great performances and, you know, the loving little looks from Dan Aykroyd or, you know, whatever. When you're looking at dailies, is anything driving you other than the typical things that drive you? Or are you thinking, oh my gosh, the fans are going to want to see this this reaction from Dan Aykroyd or Bill Murray or whoever?
I sort of edit a little atypically, in some, especially on a film like this. Sometimes I do it the other way, where I just sit down and watch raw dailies. On this, I usually watch the beginning of every take, like for a little bit, and sort of like figuring out my way in. I find if I sometimes watch those things, and if I fall in love with a look, like, oh, the fans are going to love this, I realize I subconsciously contort my entire edit to do this one thing that I don't even know if I need yet. And I figure to myself, like, if I edit this scene sort of like a Tetris, where I'm just like looking at the beginning of every single shot, I'm like, okay, how do I end, what do I go do next, it's a maze, but I'm looking at everything I have to wind myself through the maze. If I find that look and it's good, it'll still be good, but I'll have more context if it's useful in that part of the scene. And that's the way I sort of get around those kinds of things. And in the construct, you will always find out in the, you know, the bigger picture, the fans are going to love this, this is going to love that. But in very rare instances are we doing things for the fans. We're just doing it for the story. We want it for the story to make sense, for the comedy to land, for the drama to land. And that's why I kind of focus on what's the beginning and the next thing that's going to get me the most emotion, the biggest, the funniest way in or the scariest way in, and then just find myself through that. And oftentimes I get to a dead end of that maze and I have to go backwards. That's how we actually avoid that, which I think can be a detriment if you sort of focus too hard on what's going to make the fans happy, because in the end you're making something that the fans are going to be happy with if the story's good.
It sounds like you would not be a selects reel guy, because there's no reason watching all the selects for a film when all you're really trying to find are the first 10 seconds or something.
I make my selects backwards when I am creating those elements and I find something that's not working, but I still like it. I copy it. I put it away in my sandbox. And then my sandbox ends up with all these things I liked, but I couldn't find a place for as I was constructing.
What about you, Shane? What's your approach to dailies in a scene?
That's so interesting hearing that, because we do work a little bit differently, but Nathan and I were always so aligned creatively on anything we did. We never had a different rhythm or a different sensibility. My way into that is, listen, I'm a Ghostbusters fan. I grew up with Ghostbusters and I'm a fan of films. So when I select, I can't really get the scene working until I've I want to say I've watched every single thing, but what I kind of do is I make a lot of markers on takes, and I just sort of use my finger as a like lie detector test. Like when I'm feeling something that is interesting from someone, even if it's out of context, like, wow, that was an interesting little moment, or that was an interesting pondering moment, or whatever it is, I let that guide it. So if you look at mine, I'll have takes that just are like completely covered in markers, and then one that have one little thing to maybe go check out here and there. When I feel like I've taken all that in, then I can start putting the scene together. And then as I'm putting the scene together, I'm sort of like by sense memory, remembering like that felt like a really honest and pure moment. Let me try that. Doesn't mean it always works. It's certainly not in service of what I think the fans are going to want. It's in service of myself as the first fan enjoying that moment from that character that I like so much.
With this kind of a movie that has great comedy and also the scariness of it, I won't call it horror, but something close. Talk about the broader pacing of tonal moments.
We would watch the movie as a long play a lot. It's in the macro sense. We got to the library too slow. How do we get to this plot too fast, point faster? And then you have to figure out what do you not really, really need before then. Or yeah, when does this scene overstate its welcome? It's just like, sort of like how, you know, Shane was mentioning is the litmus test of sort of like, you gotta be like, oh, when is the movie pushing me out? All right, when am I back in? When is the movie pushing me out? And then sort of debating that with Gil and his sensibilities of, you know, when those moments would happen. We're usually all very in sync with the two of us. It's a matter of how we accomplish it.
There's so many variables to this film. There's so many characters and there's so many tones to juggle. And you don't really know where they are until you start stacking them together. And then you start feeling really jerked out or into a moment. It was really about creating enough time for each character to service them throughout the film, while also elevating the stakes enough that the motor keeps going. And, you know, there were times where you would have a scene in a certain place and you would just feel like all the momentum of what we just built has just died, you know? And then do we need that scene, or do we fold that scene into something else, or does that scene go before something else? So along with Gil, it was a matter of really just getting onto the ride and then staying on that ride. That's the great thing about Ghostbusters is you can take the comedy and the horror at the same time, right? It's just about like, am I here all of a sudden and I'm feeling this, and then, whoa, I'm back here. And you know, it's a very delicate balance to weave comedy, horror, hints of romance, hints of friendship, family desire, internal desire, and to put all that washing around into one film. It was a massive balancing act.
I love the idea Nathan mentioned of watching the long play a lot. The cutting together of the scenes is really pretty quick in the overall scheme of things, and the rest of it is trying to make the entire movie work. Any other thoughts about that process post cutting a rough cut together?
I have never worked on a film that had such a high degree of domino effects. Obviously, of course, any movie, the whole point is that you cut this. To most, it's like you're zooming out on like almost infinite puzzles or whatever. It's like you're cutting the beat, and then you have this like a few lines, and then you have this rough scene, and then you have this 10-minute chunk, and then you have a reel, and then you watch the movie, and then you just keep going back in and back forth. I have never had a movie where it wasn't obvious all the time what wasn't working, because what we would find is what something was off. Like the train got derailed, and the movie was like, for 10 minutes, you're like, no, what's not working? This 10-minute chunk was working 2 weeks ago. We hadn't changed these two scenes or whatever. Why is this no longer working? Oh, the problem is actually 2 minutes prior. This change actually derailed our train of thought. This movie has so many characters, so many plots, so many things to juggle. It's mystery, it's comedy, horror, tension, tone, everything. There's all these different things that it's attempting to do. And when one thing gets derailed, oftentimes in a different tone, different plot, different subplot, whatever, it actually affected all this other stuff before we actually figured out it's over here. It was very, very weird to work like on that. I'd never had, it's usually when the train goes off the rails, you kind of know exactly when and why.
Yeah, it was a massive detective case all the time. And it required watching the long play a lot and just being really honest with yourself. Sometimes it would just be as simple as a line or a scene just playing too long, or the tone should be scarier than it was. We've made it too light, and now I'm not feeling any threat down the road. Nathan's right. It was a massive ripple effect when you have this many characters and these many things going on in a film like this.
Can either of you think of an example of that, something that got pulled out or put in that created that ripple effect?
I think what it was for us was device and rules of the threat. And one of the massive things that we did near sort of the middle toward the end of the film was when Nadim comes in and drops the orb onto Ray's desk in Ray's occult, there was a ripple effect within the room. The book shaked, things came to life. You know, you felt like something was happening inside that orb, but it wasn't reaching out beyond there. And what we started to do later on was we have in that scene now, ice starts to sort of ripple through the streets to the containment unit. And it was connecting those dots right away, let the audience know that something's going on between these two things communicating. And that didn't come until much later in the film. But when you do something just as simple as that, it was like, okay, now there's a ticking clock on these two things coming together. And so then we'd have a scene that would be like everyone sitting around a table talking about something that's happening, but you're like, the threat's going on behind the scenes, guys. Like, we're already ahead of this. So now this scene needs to go away. And now we need to find a way to tell what the information that we need from this scene somewhere else, because the clock has been ticking from the beginning. And just a device like that really changed the way that the rest of the pacing worked, sort of in between that period, condensed itself in a way instead of allowing it to breathe like a normal story might.
It definitely added like an undertone of threat to any time we would cut to the, you know, the orb. And now that you know and linked what it could do, the scene in where the power goes out in the lab and the orb start like gets cracked open a little bit by the chamber. And we called it like he had like a toe out in the real world and had all this power all of a sudden before the orb sort of, you know, retracted. Is that we moved that scene earlier. That is one thing that we just moved it, I think, a few scenes earlier. Adding that threat earlier into the scene added the mechanic and a motor of the plot. So that, like, because we had all these, you know, character scenes and, you know, funny scenes that we knew were funny, but they weren't if you watch him in a run and you hadn't had a story with a threat around these scenes. It was very confusing for a while that we knew these scenes worked, but and then all of a sudden, if you move the threat earlier, now those scenes could be funny because you want to laugh after being thrilled.
Before the orb comes into Ray's occult shop, there's a little foreshadowing because the scene right before that is the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man like scurrying, right? They know the orb is on its way or here.
Exactly. And I think in the script that functioned as what we did with the ice linking across the city. It was the intention of show something scary, but in the end you're like, okay, the marshmallows are scared of it. Why should I be?
Within the script, there was always this containment unit that was bringing us back to what the Ghostbusters are, where they started, what's really happening within the operation that they've been doing for this many years. And this containment unit was a device that we kept coming to. But what we needed to do was show that there was a cosmic connection between these two elements and that our characters and our audience is going to go on the journey of like, how are these two things going to merge? And so we had the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man being scared, but it really has nothing to do with the Ghostbusters. By doing that, it has something to do with the Ghostbusters, but they don't know that yet. They're figuring that out with our audience. And so it's like really powerful little moves that we had to do in chess pieces. And it was a very malleable edit. You could really move scenes around a lot, which is fun and exciting, but also times a bit of a headache because there's so much clarity that you have to happen and you have to be servicing everybody and you have to spend all this time with them. So there's a lot of things weaving throughout the body of this movie, but it's good. We figured out the domino set in a way that we feel really, really proud of, but there was a lot of moving pieces in this one. It was an interesting edit.
What about the score? You've got this great legacy of music themes that you have to play with going back to the original Ghostbusters. How much of that stuff did you use as you were trying to build cuts, or did you stay away from that?
There were definitely some moments we did, but I think Shannon and I had a conversation about this when we both started in London. We definitely wanted to use it for certain elements and fanfares, but I had felt like, you know, in Afterlife, we really leaned in a good way, in a way that this franchise needed, to Elmer Bernstein and the score. And obviously this film would do the same, but maybe let's try taking it in a new direction. Let's try taking it into, you know, scarier territory in a lot of ways. And so it was something that Shane and I were excited about when we were temping, and I think Gil was around for it and embraced it, and so did Dario, and I think we found a really good balance. Tell me, it was a little hard on something like this because you expect certain fanfares and certain things, but you also, you know, we want to push it into something new.
Did you try to map it out at all? Like, oh, this moment has got to have a classic Ghostbuster theme. This moment shouldn't.
Yeah. Shane would cut like the Slimer scene in the attic. Your instinct and the correct one sort of put in the little trail of anticipation and threat right when he turns his head. And that I don't think ever changed.
What else did you temp with? Did you find that you were temping outside of Ghostbusters universe because you needed those tonal feelings?
Yeah, I temped a lot with like Conjuring scores, and the original Friday the 13th scores were really cool. Like, we were starting to use them in the lab because they had these really tense strings. They were a little too far in the end, but I think, like Nathan's saying, I think the idea was, how do we push this into a new place? And sometimes the horror scores felt like they were just trying too hard, but it was an interesting place to work from because you would start to craft a scene like a horror scene and not play it like a Ghostbusters scene. And it was really effective, I think, in allowing us to sort of genre each section and then find ways to pull all that together in a thread that felt like it was deserving of Ghostbusters, but was pushing it into a new space. So yeah, lots of just tonal horror film. Like, I noticed that my kids, they're 9 and 7. If I show them something that is physically scary, if I show them a zombie thing, whatever, it's like pretty ineffective. But if there's tension and something happening that they don't see, it gets them every time. So I think when we were thinking for kids as an audience in that first, those first thrills in the theater, it was like, how do we just hold these moments with the tension of a horror film, but we're not delivering something that feels terrifying as a horror film, but we're allowing kids a space to feel something is unsteady and uncertain. So a lot of those more ethereal, drony type of temp scores were really cool pieces to use in the attic, in the lab, et cetera.
Nathan mentioned London. I'm assuming you guys were there. That's where you edited?
Yes.
Is there an advantage to being close to set?
Oh, on this one, yeah. Gil was in mostly every night after wrapping. We were right on next to the lot and right next to production. So he would pop over for 45 minutes or so after he'd shoot. And, you know, it was fun. He'd come in and have a really great attitude about what they shot that day and you know, tell us what he was excited about and brought in a good energy in the room. And then it would allow Nathan and I to have a scene that we were working on that morning, that sometimes we would just get that scene that morning, watch the dailies, rough it. And we were all in such a place of trusting each other and moving at a good enough pace that we could show that rough cut that night, get Gil's first reactions, address those notes, and then kind of push that off to the side and get on to the next thing. And so it was really beneficial to be in close proximity.
It was really nice. And sometimes we would go to set too, but not as much as on Afterlife. I was on set for 4 weeks, 5 weeks during the very end of the production. I don't think we did anything like that on this. Maybe towards just the third act, I was on set with my laptop cutting in video assist footage. But yeah, it was really beneficial to be this very close.
Why did they need to have you cutting off video assist?
That I've experienced that almost on every third act. Any film that I think films any amount of blue screen for your third act or CG characters or villains or whatever. When you're getting towards the end, it's down the wire, and you don't have a lot of time left with your actors, and you're trying to just make sure all this stuff fits and you have everything you need. It's a gigantic puzzle when you have all those characters there in terms of getting the beats that were required to tell the story, and then skipping ones you don't. Skipping ones that you know you're like, oh, we're cutting to this and cutting back to this. They could have moved on, or they could have done this or that, and it's a big, big map. In the script, you can read it and you just visualize, assume it works, and then you put on the timeline and you're like, wait, we really need something that goes from this to this. And so it's just obvious to be there in real time and not wait. That's those are the moments you can't wait for the end of the day to come back and be like, we just destroyed this part of the set today because we thought we were done.
Yeah, we had a couple moments like in the lab too where we were able to run in at the end of the day, and when they were wrapping shooting, we just go, can we just pick this off and this off? And they're like, great, you know, and we'd run in and get a couple of ideas and ducked out of your computer, ran across the street and went and got two things that you felt like you could use and then came back. And that was incredibly helpful.
What was the politics of that? Were you talking to Gil and asking a favor, or were you on second unit or somebody that was doing that for you?
It was always with Gil. I think we just, we had a really great working relationship with him because he was so invested in coming into the edit. I think we all felt invested in the story that we were trying to tell, and he respected if we had an idea, and we'd go to him and, we'd just say, hey, like, if we can do this, this might be cool. And he was totally open to it. And sometimes he wouldn't agree with it and we wouldn't do it. And it was fine. It was always one of those things where you come in and you just go, I don't think anything's wrong here. But like, if we had this, it might give us this little, window for suspense, or it might give us this little bit of story that we feel like we're missing. And that's just the benefit of A, being all close together, being close in what we're doing together, but respecting each other creatively. It wasn't really political in any way. It was always to service the best idea for that scene.
What about the stuff that was shot in New York, or was there nothing? There has to been something that was shot in New York, right? So, and that was all delivered. Do you always edited in London, or did you move over to LA or anything for any part of it?
Nathan should talk about, because he did the sewer dragon chase, and that was really interesting in the way that that was designed, because it's fascinating, and watching him work in that way was really inspiring. And he's had so much control and imagination to know how to put that together. And but anyway, I'll let him talk to them.
Thank you, Shane. It was actually interesting. It was kind of the opposite of the Munter chase in Afterlife. In Afterlife, they had storyboards to go off of, and then I had edited the storyboards with full-on music, sound effects. It was basically like a mini animated film. Felt great, loved it. And then they shot the second unit footage on it. And of course, going from storyboards to not even post-viz or previous, excuse me, and then shooting it, there are things that are work on board than you just mechanically cannot get in real life. So it just turned out some scenes different. So I edited that during production and then had the storyboards in place of what they were going to shoot on the screen, on the stage, in the car with the kids. And that way we had this very clear map of what we needed to get inside the car on a blue screen. Blue screen stage is where you have the most control to get what you need. Because of the schedule in this, New York was going to happen at the end when they shot the exteriors of the dragon chase and all the plates and everything. So we had the sequence with Previs and then what they shot on set with the family in the car. Became very integrated with Jeff on the script, this VFX supervisor. We actually sent our VFX supervisor to go to New York, not just the second unit director, but him to basically oversee all of this. And how is it going to fit into our already existing cut sequence with blue screens and the family in the car? Because it was a lot to match up, and I thought they just did a tremendous job. And when we got the New York stuff back, it was just like, oh, great, they did four takes, and take three and four are great, and I'm just going to cut this in. And it kind of just slotted in really well. And then, of course, the next, 6 to 9 months, it was more about just trimming the dialogue scene and making it the scene as sharp as possible. It was not at all difficult to, in terms of the mechanics of how it worked in New York. And then to answer your question about New York and timing, so with the shooting was 3 months in London. We did 3 months of the director's cut in London too. So I was in London for 6 months. And then we came back to finish out the rest of the film, work with the producers, work with Sony and VFX. And then start our sound mix DI this last January, February.
In LA.
In LA, yeah, so.
You mentioned the need to be able to use your imagination on VFX. So I'd like to talk a little bit about this movie's got a ton of VFX. I have never worked on a movie with a huge amount of VFX. And so talk to me about editing, and you're missing a huge chunk of what you're actually editing with until 6 months later. That's when you really get something to look at.
I found this really fascinating because this is my first time with a big VFX film. I thought that that would be something very challenging, but what I really enjoyed about it was that you had all these other little bits of nuance that you were constructing in the performance of these monsters. Now, some of it was practical. Slimer, we had they built a practical Slimer and moved him around like a puppet. And some of that would work, some of that wouldn't work. And so with something like Slimer, you'd basically look at like what's really working from the practical performance, what are we missing? What do we need to mock up and post-viz to make this scene actually play? But something like Garaka, you'd have all this pre-viz And then you'd start looking at like, how do we make him more menacing? And how do we tether him to this shot where his hands are clenching and the ice is clenching behind him, which I love. There was such an amazing extra layer of filmmaking attached to that. It wasn't a hindrance. It wasn't a nuisance. It was actually always like, how do we keep stacking little details to bring this character to life? And you just heavily work with Gil, Nathan and I and VFX, and you just keep going at it, you know, similar to what I would imagine doing animation feels like. Because that was my experience with it. I found it really fun, and there was enough in the previs that we can make sense of what we wanted the scenes to do. And there was enough practically done that you weren't just like, here's a tennis ball and someone's looking at it. And now we all have to imagine that this isn't happening. Like, I think Gil did a really great job of shooting in a way that we could absolutely imagine what we wanted and needed. And then it was just about executing it.
No, Gil was great on set. He'd always be basically narrating the film to the actors over the microphone of like, and Rock is doing this. And, you know, he didn't want the actors, I think, or even us to think that we had to remember off the script what was happening. They just wanted them to, all you need to remember is your lines and reacting to what's happening. You don't even remember because it's like, copy, it's kind of beats. He's like, and then he blows this lighter out, and then he like, death chills. It's like all this stuff. And then, you know, inevitably you do get to a point where you end up with some empty plates for VFX and you just have text on screen that says, Graca close up. That's the tricky part where you're doing so much mental gymnastics to even get to the point of imagining what the scene is, that it's hard for you to judge what your emotion is. I think it was different than Afterlife, because I think Graca to me is much scarier as a villain, just as is visually and what he's capable of. But it wasn't until we started getting actual renders from SPI, the vendor. They're like, oh, Garaka's freaky looking. He's scary. And it's one thing to be able to use your imagination that you're looking at a, like PlayStation 3 level graphics version. I shouldn't say PlayStation 3, maybe 2 or 2.5.
In other words, pre-viz or post-viz.
Exactly. You're looking at these level graphics and you're asking an even, you know, a preview audience, for instance, to be scared of it. And Afterlife, at least we had like Gozer and a person in a suit. And the dogs were dogs, and you can understand that. But your main villain being CG, that's what I realize is a huge challenge. Trying to make it more, you know, like a horror-esque, you know, genre villain. It's a challenge, and sound is a huge thing. And I'm glad that Shane and I do so many sound effects so that the timings of things are there for the VFX team.
To piggyback on what you're saying, the challenge was we were working so hard to make Graca scary because he's looking like a PlayStation 2 character. We're really, really trying to deliver this huge emotion and write out something that is not there, which really takes quite a lot of imagination and faith that it's going to turn out that way, you know, and then you just shepherd that process. But once it becomes real and feeling more real, then you can pull back. But we were never really off on what that was. It was just existing in our minds and just a slower process than having an actor perform it.
You mentioned graphic on screen, Garaka close up. Is there an advantage or a disadvantage to grabbing some concept art of Garaka and sticking that in? Or are you actually better off putting in the text?
I meant the text only for us internally to judge. I don't think we'd ever screen that way. Not to anyone that's not a producer. Like, that would be only for us internally to figure out before we asked an artist to draw something or post-viz to put something in. It was only a matter of the three of us.
We had to do a lot of drafts of the ending. And so a lot of times it would just be like, I got an idea. I'm gonna go in the room and I'm just going to do this. And then you just go and you do something. The real pleasure and joy of working with Nathan is that we were really not precious about it. So Nathan would have a structure of something. I'd go take it and do this. He'd come back and go, I like this, but like these rules don't work for me. And then he'd take it and do something else. And then I'd tonally do something. And it was almost like pitching in a room, like, stay with me here. His hand's going to come in, and then this is going to happen here, and that's going to happen there. And, you know, if you're waiting for those elements to come in, you're just wasting your time. Better for us to work fast, pitch ideas in the room to Gil or Jason or each other, and then find out what we wanted to do and then go down that road. So that was Text is no fun to look at when you're watching a cut, but for us, it was absolutely helpful when it's a day-long process, you know?
Sometimes I think if it's like an uncanny valley thing where if you are too close but not right, it's worse than just.
Yeah, sometimes it's effective to just say, this is the idea. Because when you start to put something physical in its place, your mind starts to believe that that's what's happening in the scene. When you put text on, you know what the intention of the scene is. And sometimes it's about being simpler. Bring it down to something that is just simple that we get right now. And then we know the process and we know the people who are going to make this come to life. But the idea just has to be, what are we trying to tell in this moment right now? What is the, if this hand is going to come down, why is it coming down? And if we can just place it there, we can piece it together in our heads. If I see a hand, all of a sudden it becomes a real hand, and then I'm questioning why it's there and what the scale of it and this and that. And it emotionally takes me out of it.
On Afterlife, I'd have boards of Muncher that I just cut out. And I had like five different positions of him. This way, turn around, screaming, whatever. And I would just float him around on the screen in keyframes, like a Mario ghost. And but because he's black and white in an illustration, it was much better than if I had like actually like the same three stages of that posing in like a 3D render. It's more easy for your brain to see how the simplicity of it. It's more work for your brain to look at it, something that's closer than it's real.
As long as it's not the final audience, let the viewer fill it in with their own imagination. You mentioned sound effects. Talk to me a little bit about how much you filled in sound effects, because sound effects for me is one of those things that with VFX, it feels like they make the VFX more real. Like you watch VFX without the sound effects, and a lot of time you're like, well, that's hokey. And then you put the sound effects in, you're like, well, that's real.
Totally. Sound on this film was very interesting, and Shane and I are both driven very much like love editing with sound effects, and we actually never even do a traditional temp mix for all our screenings. We just did our temp mix out of Avid. You know, we have brilliant assistants, Nicholas Lundgren and Ali Andres, who, as well as the others, who just cut wonderful sounds for us.
Instrumental and sound designing sections that we couldn't hit, but also just constantly staying up with our mix and keeping it balanced in a way that we could screen the film. They worked really tirelessly on the sound design because we previewed it out of Avid Mix, I think a few times. Sound for me is always as important a component to building a scene as the visuals. Even if it's the absence of sound, that's equally important. It's my way to convey the way that I want to feel about a scene, whether or not it's poppy and electric, or whether or not it's internal and quieter. And I couldn't imagine making any scene work without cutting it that way. So because it's so important to Nathan and I, like everything would come baked with the sound pass. We work fast and get a scene together. And obviously, like you're not spending all of your day working on the sound design. But when we were doing like mini puffs running around, you know, you're adding all these screams and fires and little laughs, and you know, like we had this track of them kind of speaking gibberish, and you know, you just start messing with like where those go. And then when we're in the really, really early rudimentary stage, you could not even see a Stay Puft. I think some of the first plates we had of Phoebe kind of coming down and discovering one of them, you just hear him go like, oh, you know, and you immediately start being charmed. Or we'd have him be really happy right before podcast smashes him, you know, and really build up this like joy, this really childlike baby that's reaching out. A lot of those were used before we had the visuals to support them. But then you go, oh, I know what this scene's doing. But if we just had plates and Phoebe going down and music, it wouldn't be effective, you know.
How much do you like to rely on your assistants to do that stuff, and how much do you feel like you need to do it? And also, did you get a sound effect like toolbox to work with, or you just used the previous movie?
Especially during the sequel, I kind of figured it'd be easy to pull out the previous movie's library, but we didn't end up using it or grabbing or getting it. I don't know.
No, just
I
like
think it's
proton beams or something like
yeah,
that, right?
proton beams. Like we got some stuff from Will Files and his team and the sound design team. I think Shane and I are very, very in sync with this. Is for the sounds that are integral into the tone of finding the scene, even if it's a background droney something, or if it's a specifics of when someone's hitting a button on a machine, or especially like a creature ghost sound or something like that, doesn't mean I usually need to cut in. I could ask them, hey, I put in a bad version of this, can you replace it? but at least the timing's there. Or we can ask him, can you find me, I'll ask him for a little toolboxes, can you find me 10 creepy this sounds that I want? And I'll usually will cut the scene or be recutting it and have that a sound pass built in that is sort of a rhythm, at least to the scene. If there's something that's happening that's supposed to be where when we get quiet, when we get loud, the machine turning on, becoming scary and extracting Phoebe's spirit, stuff like that. If then if you looked at the big picture, you'd have these scenes that are like, these 20 seconds are incredibly well sound designed of a scene and the rest of it's pretty good. And then you have scenes that have nothing. And it's their job to literally make the whole movie sound as good as those 20 seconds that I spent my time on.
Is it something that you do or something that you assign to an assistant to go through the script and go, okay, there's a ton of frozen ice. There's a ton of big, scary machines powering up and powering down.
Just pull libraries? Is that what you're asking?
At what point do you start to try to find the stuff that you know you're going to need? Like, you could have done that before they shot.
I mean, it's a great point. It is what we did. You would definitely be like, give me a big, let's go into ice and all the different versions of ice, right? Like the from the vapor to the crystallization to the cracking through walls. You would definitely get the machinery, the proton packs, cars, those like main things, Walla, Foley, those things that just sort of exist in the background, city environments, et cetera. You get those. And then if you're building a scene, like a lot of times you just base lay some of that stuff in so that it has environment. When I start on a scene, if I'm going to start on Trevor in the Attic, I go, look, just look through the dailies. What's happening? There's a giant wooden door that's creaking and falling. There's a big trash pile. There's dripping goo. There's footsteps. I like to have sound effects bins that are like by scene. They start that way. And then usually I have enough in there to not have to carry that process on the whole time. After you know, a month, you probably have enough of like everything to make anything work. And then if you get really granular, you can just ask for that.
Nathan, what about you? Do you try to either prep yourself or have an assistant start early looking for those sounds and starting to build bins of stuff, or is it per scene?
I've been fortunate to not even be able to answer that question because I rolled right into this from another movie, or I was on a short vacation right beforehand, went to the premiere of John Wick, and showed up a week or a week and a half late where Shane was already working to London. So I didn't have time to do anything preparing or even asking Nicholas to get ahead. I mean, yeah, I knew the script and I was very familiar with the script and I worked on the previs a little bit. But it's just, you know, like, also assistants are so good at like grabbing stuff. And once you have the scene visually in front of you, it just kind of makes sense to start building that ice library as you need it, as you think about it, because you can spend a ton of time trying to grab it before production. And then, you know, once you start putting it against dialogue, you're like, oh, that's not going to work. We need something that sounds totally different.
Last question for both of you is, if there's a scene that you could talk about that was either much harder than it looked on the screen, oh, that looks like you just threw that together, but no, it took months, or the opposite, or just something you felt was challenging or you're proud of, each one of you pick a scene. Shane, could you go first?
I'm going to talk probably about the Venkman Nadim scene with the pasta strainer on his head. What was really hard about the scene, there was quite a bit of dialogue cut out of it. Venkman has a pen throw. He throws the pen at Nadim, I think, once. But because Bill does it in different ways, he would just do them at different times while shooting a scene. When you took some of the dialogue out that you needed to take out, but still convey what's happening with the fire, I started to use the pen as a device to keep getting him more and more upset. So I would reuse what was really like one piece of blocking with Venkman, you know, in three different ways to build this Nadim kind of being like, what's happening here, to stop throwing that pen at me, to I'm about to like lose control here. I was really proud of the way that the pen turned into this device to not only comedically make the scene successful, but to allow Nadim's character to be pushed over the edge by the sparring partner that he had in Venkman.
This kitchen with Nadim was so weirdly tricky because you're going from what's supposed to be really scary to something that's like a building tension that Trevor is going to get blasted, to he's being saved, to a heroic superhero-esque moment, to the comedy It's the most tonally schizophrenic of any scene I've ever worked on. And I'm actually very proud that I think the final version is not that far off from where I started or where we all started on that scene. It just took a lot of experimentation to nail you to those moments. And that's a scene where the VFX, like, there's so much that's going on that the post-viz versions of them, you can't tell if you're laughing at this joke because it's funny or if you're laughing at this joke because it's a really bad CG version of the final thing. And it wasn't until we really started getting the last shot, and it's one of the later shots delivered, we started getting renders of it, and we're like, oh my God, I think this is going to work. And now I just think that the scene displays wonderfully, and I'm really proud of it.
Gentlemen, I've taken up enough of your time. It was wonderful talking to you about this movie. Hope everybody gets a chance to see it in the theater.
Thank you so much for your time, and thanks for watching and enjoying the movie. Hope you guys enjoy it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That's it for Out of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to Nathan Orloff and Shane Reed for discussing Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. Thanks also to our partner, BorisFX. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. Thanks for listening, and please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And if you want a good follow on socials, I'm on Twitter and Instagram as @SteveHallfish.